Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Echoes. I'm Paula Schiller with our annual Festival of Native Arts sampler. The Festival of Native Arts is in its seventh year. It's organized primarily by Native students at the University of Alaska with a lot of help from their friends. Each night of the week-long festival is devoted to a different Native cultural group, from Barrow to Kluwak and over to the Pribilof Islands, where we'll begin with the Aleut group and the St. George Anthem. The Aleut group also sang church music in Aleut and Slavonic, and then demonstrated some Aleut games. One is a guessing gambling game which involves the trading of songs back and forth between opponents and onlookers.
So now it's Alfred's turn to sing a song. He could pick his choice of his song since he had won that round.
Chok my chola iola, chok my chola iola. I am in the heart, chim chim heart. I am in the heart, chim chim heart. Chok my chola iola, chok my chola iola. I am in the heart, chim chim heart. I am in the heart, chim chim heart.
On the other nights, several different performing groups represented each language and culture, so I had to let the acoustics decide which songs to put in this sampler. I tried to pick ones with the softest drumming and the clearest voices. In the case of Athabaskan Night, the group from Kaltag and Nulato didn't use a drum at all, so the choice was easy. Here's a perennial favorite, Goodbye Sonny, written for the boys going off to World War II.
Hey!
Singing, dancing, and drumming is a strenuous business. So the Hinya dancers from Kluwak Junior High in Southeastern sat down for the rest song, which also happens to be a love song. Eskimo songs tend to start out quietly enough, with the drummers tapping the rims of their big hoop drums. But after the introductions, they get down to real business, as we'll hear in this Inupiaq song from the Wainwright Group. The students from Nome Belts High School perform both Inupiaq and Siberian Yupik songs and dances on different nights. Here they do an old Siberian Yupik song from St. Lawrence Island. It was made in celebration of a successful whale hunt. Whether the dancers were high school students, elders from villages, or a combination of all ages, for the most part, the drummers and song leaders were older people. The one exception is the Nunamta dancers, who are university students from the lower Kuskokwim area. They got together to share their songs and have fun. They wrap up this program with a Yupik hunting song.
Yeah. Harlem, Aachen, Wuppertal, Amsterdam, Akhadara.
The crowds filled the concert hall every night, and after each performance, the applause was long and loud. Another good time had by all at the 7th Annual Festival of Native Arts. You've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. The Cooperative Park Studies Unit on the University of Alaska campus employs 10 archaeologists and anthropologists who have been spending their summers in Prince William Sound, Seward Peninsula, and Southeastern and Arctic Village in the interior. They spend their winters writing up their reports on the 14H1 sites they've been documenting. Wendy Arendale is project coordinator. She explains what 14H1 is and what all those people are doing out there in the field.
14H1 was an attempt to provide the native corporations with a way of claiming historic and cemetery sites that were important to them, that were in their area, that were part of their heritage, that contained information or were associated with stories or myths or history or heritage in some way. And the provisions allow them to claim, the native corporations that is, to claim a certain amount of acreage, it varies from corporation to corporation, that has this kind of import for the people. The first part of the program, if you could call it that, I guess we refer to it generally sort of phase one, came about in January of 75 when all of the corporations were facing the deadline for making land selections under all the different provisions of ANCSA. And some of the corporations were finding it difficult to get the information they needed to nominate 14H sites.
And I mean, they didn't know where the sites were, or didn't have the surveying done, or what kind of problem?
Well, many of the areas of Alaska are not well known from an archaeological standpoint. And while the people themselves in the native communities knew about many of these sites, the information was not always available readily to the corporations who had to make the nominations. So at that point, our organization was formed, and people from our organization went out to various villages, interviewed older people or people knowledgeable about native heritage and sites, and they also went through the archaeological literature and the historic literature on Alaska and made lists of sites and put together statements of significance and other information that the corporations could use in nominating sites for the first part of the program, because before we can even begin to look at a site, the site had to be nominated. And all that had to be done at the same time that all the other land nominations were being made. So there was a tremendous pressure on the corporations, and this was one way that we were able to assist them at that time, so that they had a broad range of sites and as many sites as possible to choose from.
How come the Park Service was involved in this? It seems to me that the corporations, the native corporations, would be responsible entirely for making the nominations and investigating the areas.
The National Park Service, until very recently, has traditionally been the government's archaeologist, so to speak. And so when the rules and regulations were set out, the rules stipulated that the sites have to meet certain criteria of significance in order to be eligible for conveyance. The criteria that were ultimately chosen, and there was some considerable debate over what the criteria should be. Many Native people felt that the criteria should be generated from their own culture, and I think we can all understand why that might be. But the National Register of Historic Sites have a set of criteria which are legally tested, which have the force of law, and there's a great deal of concern that if a legally tested set of criteria were not used, then there would be a lot of court contests over the legality of the conveyance. And so the rules and regulations specify that the National Register criteria, or something very, very similar to them, will be used to determine the significance of the sites. And what we try to do, in fact, probably one of our main functions, is to talk to local people, to from our background and information, try to understand how they view the significance of the site, and then interpret that significance in terms of the criteria for the National Register, so that the things that the people feel are significant about the sites are not lost, so that they are there. They are just, in a sense, reinterpreted in terms of a legally tested framework.
You talked about phase one, and that's the nomination phase?
Right. We're now in what I guess you might call phase two.
Does that mean all the nominations are in?
That's right. All the nominations had to be in, and I wasn't with the program at this time, so I'm not sure of the exact date, but early 1976, sometime in 1976. The deadline was set once and then extended, so I can't remember exactly the date, but at that point. Now we are in the process of fulfilling that requirement of the rules and regulations that has to do with determining site significance. Our job is primarily the research, the archaeological survey of the site. We go to each site, usually initially with someone from a local community, although this isn't always possible. In some areas like Southeast, the sites have already been thoroughly located through a previous survey, but in some of the other areas, all the other areas, we try to initially visit the site with someone from a local community who's knowledgeable about the site, who knows exactly where it is, knows something about its history. We spend some time with them, usually with a tape recorder, walking around on the site, getting them to tell us about what they know about the site, who perhaps built any structures that are there, if that's known, what some of the features of the site were used for, how old the site might be, how the site fit into the native culture, whether it was used for subsistence, whether it was associated with religious practices or stories or particular events or individuals that were outstanding in the heritage or the history of the local people. Whatever about that site that makes it important to them.
Would these be mostly sites where there were dwellings, a village or a camp, or would some of them just be a particular fork in the river or a particular hill or something like that? What kind of thing?
They vary widely. One thing about 14-H sites is that they tend to be out away from established communities. Areas that were in places that were used over long periods of time and are still being used generally are not available for selection as 14-H1 because they're being selected under other provisions of ANCSA. But we find a wide variety of sites. Just as an example, in one area where we're working, for example, the Arctic Village area, we have a large number of caribou fences and the features associated with them. On the Seward Peninsula, which is the second area where we're working, we have subsistence sites, areas that were used for muskrat trapping. We have loam and reindeer herders' cabins. We have cabins associated with subsistence activities and reindeer herding activities, and prominent people among the residents of that area. On Prince William Sound, which is the second area or third area that we're working in, we have a wide range of sites. For example, a copper mining site, garden sites, village sites, winter village sites, temporary summer sites, smokehouse sites, salmon fishing locations, a weir location in one situation. A community known as Nuchek, which was an important Russian and Native community after the time of Russian contact. Southeast also has a wide variety of sites. That's the fourth area we've been working in. There we have prehistoric village sites, historic village sites, garden sites, rocks that were used as defensive locations. We have those in Prince William Sound, too. Just a whole variety of places where people went to carry on their lives during prehistoric and historic times. And it depends in part on the culture of the area where we're working, what kinds of sites occur there and are nominated.
There's always the complaint that I hear from Native villagers is that these sociologists, anthropologists, oral historians, everybody comes in with their tape recorders, their notebooks, traipses around for, you know, weeks, and they're feeling just slightly abused by that. And some of the people that do come in are rather insensitive to the people that are living there.
This can be a real problem. We have talked to the Native corporations and indicated to them that we're very interested in hiring and involving in the project people from the particular areas where we worked from, where we're working right now. We have had some success with this. Some last year we had three people working on the project who were Native Corporation members from various areas, and we're hoping that in the future we will have more people. Bureau of Indian Affairs, with whom we work on this, is also interested in involving Native people. We see this as an opportunity to provide people from Native corporations with some training in what is known as cultural resource management. And we're very happy to do this. And we're hoping that perhaps the corporations can help us find people who would be interested in being involved in this kind of work and who could then carry it on within their corporation once their involvement with ANCSA 14-H came to an end. We think that there's a tremendous amount of information and resources there. One of the problems for both us and for the corporations is finding the money to hire and train people. But we're more than willing to look very hard for that kind of money in order to provide people with that experience. and we think it's very important. We're also quite concerned about how our interviewing is done. It is a real problem because there are a lot of people who want to talk to people in the villages and gather this kind of information. We are doing our best to feed the information back that we gather back to people in the communities. And we hope that as much of the information as we can go back and be useful to people in the schools, to people who are interested in their own heritage, to people who can actually use the information in understanding themselves and their history.
Wendy Arendale is project coordinator for 14H1 sites with the Cooperative Park Studies Unit. In the next few weeks, we'll have reports on what the researchers discovered in each of the four regions studied so far. For Chinook, I'm Paula Schiller. This has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.